For, okay, let me actually press continue for recording. All right, so we have four contributions in the agenda, and first two are about the dual readout. So Sang-yeon will give some presentation about the dual readout simulation tools that he developed for the FCCE, and that will be followed up by Nico's presentation about the fun for all. And we have some other we will hear some report about the EM car. In fact, we also have some contribution from Pukai that is not yet in the agenda, but we'll add it. So is there any general issues that we have to discuss before moving to Sang-yeon's presentation? If not, let's start. So Sang-yeon, would you project your slides?
Yes, just a second. Yep, you see the screen in the full screen, right?
Yep.
Okay, so let me start. So thank you for inviting me to present this presentation in the meeting. And today I'll talk about the simulation of the dual readout accelerometer overall for future collider experiments. And I'll let you know that the things that I will present in this talk is based on the many institutions, many people's work, which is based on the some group of teams of the dual readout accelerometer in the South Korea. And before I get started, let me briefly recap about the conceptions of the dual readout accelerometer. Although the main idea was already presented last week, I think a recapping it would be necessary since it's for who didn't attend the last meeting. So the main idea for dual readout accelerometer is measuring the energy in two different channels, namely scintillation and Cherenkov channels, and we have different H over E value because of the different characteristics of each particles, where the for scintillation channels we have almost every particles can't actually have the scintillation process, where for the Cherenkov process we have only mostly electrons due to the difference in the particle mass. So based on this different H over E response, if we measure the energy in two dimension, we can estimate the fraction of EM components, namely FEM, from here 0 to 1, event by event basis. By using this FEM value, we can correct the energy of hydrogen shower by the right amount, hence we can obtain very good energy resolution for both EM and hydrogen shower. The dual readout accelerometer is one of the main accelerometers discussed in the FCCE, but I won't go through the details for the entire project of FCC here. But also, let me recap about the last week's presentation. That in the last week, we mainly present about the organization, overall organization, as hardware efforts. And today I'll talk about the mainly software parts and some expected performance using the simulation, Gen4 simulation studies. Since the most of the things for the dual readout accelerometer are based on the optical fiber, so Cherenkov and Cherenkov scintillation channels are implemented in the copper absorber as optical fibers. Shown in these pictures, where the scintillation is a yellow one and the Cherenkov is the blue one. So implementing optical fibers is critical for the simulation of the dual readout accelerometer. The response of the dual readout accelerometer extensively depends on the optical properties of optical fibers, obviously. So one important thing is that the attenuation of fibers Since the during the computer is longitudinally unshaped, where the picture here in the center left is kind of a projection of the towers inside the during the computer. And you can, for example, if the particle enters and the energy is deposited in the shallow part of the tower, they have to the generated optical photons have to travel longer towards to the radial stand where the back side here. While these, for example, hadronic showers, which can deposit in the deeper and which can travel relatively shorter. So since we have the attenuation lengths of fibers in reality, so it is important to understand the effect of this kind of attenuation and correct such effects if it is needed. So we have such kind of attenuation loss, as you can see in the left but right bottom here, implemented in the GN4 simulation. And upon that, we also apply a yellow filter to mitigate the attenuation at the scintillation channel, because where the region, although it is not depicted in this plot, from 400 nanometers to 500 nanometer wavelengths, where this, most of the scintillation spectrum is located, actually the attenuation loss diverges to almost the dark region in the 400, from 500 to 400. So so we had to apply this kind of yellow filter to filter out this region from 400 to 500, so that we do not suffer from severe attenuation. And also there is one more reason to by applying this filter is that actually the light yields coming out from the scintillation channel is too large, so that if we don't apply this yellow filter here, actually the SIPMs readout systems are get saturated. So that's another reason reason that we have to apply the filter. So we also implement this kind of filter in the GN4 simulation here. And the one implemented is the Redshift number 9 filter here, as depicted here is a yellow one. And before moving go to the main topic, I want to say some other important aspects of the frame simulation framework that we are using. Is computation. So unfortunately of naive kind of full simulation of optical physics based on GN4 can actually explode the CPU costs up to hours per event. So this is because we have on order of 10,000 tracks for per photons due to total internal reflection through the fibers, as you can see in the right picture here. And this is multiplied by another factor of 10,000 photons per GeV, which is due to the scintillation process. And by multiplying these factors, this yields about 100 million tracks per GeV to compute. So the conventional solution for this is simply killing optical photons for counting, but this is not optimal for during the computer, since the numerical aperture is important for the yield of the chunk of channel, as you can see here. And also attention and timing of optical photons are important for longitudinally unsegmented collimator. Especially timing is crucial because we use it to measure the shower depth by using the fact that the detection time is the sum of time of flight of the high energy particles and the propagation time of optical photon inside the fibers. So simulating photon propagation is necessary for us, but it is dominates the CPU consumption. So the approach where we tried is that we try to improve this by estimating photon propagation more efficiently, since the total internal reflection inside the fibers shows kind of repetitive behavior, as you can see in this illustration. And we can calculate the photon's position, timing, etc., without doing full tracking. And we are developing developed a fast simulation model for optical fibers, and we presented our idea to GN4 R&D meeting in the last year of May. And the preliminary results shows excellent agreement with full simulation, and the results with the fast simulation module. For example, if you see the timing distribution here, Cherenkov and scintillation channel, blue and red one. For the computation, we can now suppress the computation time down to 4 minutes per 20 GeV electron events. But of course, there is still room to be improved, and we are putting more efforts for improving this simulation module. So now that was the story about the simulation framework. And now I will go through the how we measure the energy and the performance, estimated performance using this GeoInfo simulation. So first of all, we should have calibrate our calorimeter, and we calibrate the calorimeter using 20 GeV electron events. And by using simulation, we measure the energy deposit and scintillation, the photoelectrons of scintillation channel and Cherenkov channel for every ith power from 0 to 91st case. This is, of course, for the FCC configuration that I mentioned here. And these energies, the red one, can be expressed as a linear combination with the simulation of 92 towers from 0 to 91 here. So by solving this linear relations, we can estimate the calibration constants, which is depicted as a yellow column here. And the one you're seeing here in the bottom is the energy deposits from as a function of the where the beam is pointing. For example, the tower from 0th tower to 91st tower, and which the value is the red, the energy underbar deposit here for ith tower. As you can see, we have very linear energy around slightly smaller than 10 GeV here. For if we reconstruct energy with a full phase space, and by using this energy deposit and measure the number of counts, we can finally measure the calibration constants. And as you can see here for Cherenkov in the left and scintillation in the right, here the corrections simply means that we scale by about a factor of 19.95 over 20, which we basically fit our 20 energy response of 20 GeV electron to 20 GeV. So after the calibration, we can measure the energy response to the electromagnetic shower. And for EM energy resolution, we measured it using 8 different energy of electron beams from 5 to 110 GeV here. And as you can see, for electromagnetic shower, we have very nice Gaussian shape. For example, for 20 GeV electron, as you can see the right top here. And if we plot the resolution, which is defined as a standard deviation divided by the mean energy, and it's scaled to 1 over square root E, and we extract a stochastic and constant term by linear fitting, as you can see in the left bottom here. So for the electromagnetic shower, we expect the stochastic term of to EM shower is to be 12% for combined channel here. Here, the combined channel is simply means the sum of the scintillation and Cherenkov channel, because for electromagnetic case, the response for both channel is exactly same. And for the linearity, we can expect less than plus minus 1% for both combined and each scintillation and Cherenkov channel from 5 to 100 GeV. So after measuring resolution for electromagnetic shower, now we move our scope to hadronic as a resolution. And as similar as before, we try to measure the hadronic energy resolution with 8 different energy of pion beams. And here we apply the light attenuation and during the correction, as what I mentioned before. And what you see, for example, for 20 GeV pion is the right, the response is the right top plot here. For example, you can see that the very low response for Cherenkov channel, while we have relatively higher response for scintillation channel, which is completely expected. And if we apply the Drury regression, you can see that actually the Drury regression improves the linearity for the energy response. So by using this Drury regression energy, we all again can measure the stochastic term and the linearity. You can see that the stochastic term for pion beams is results about the 21% for Drury regression channel. And you can see that the Drury regression improved the linearity by seeing that the right bottom plot here. And the final one related to the energy resolution is the jets, which is simply based basically the multi-particle states. And we try to measure the jet energy resolution with four different energy of U quark jets, where the E plus E minus going to die jet events. With the each quark has a energy of 50 GeV to 100 GeV, and then we do the hadronization and we close the jets with anti-KT algorithm with R equal to 0.8. But here you can there is a one thing that you have to note is that the clustering performance is also very crucial for the final jet energy resolution performance. But here we want to focus on the performance of the detector itself, not the clustering. So we selected only events with cluster gen jet energy larger than 90% of truth energy. So as you can see in the right top here. And after this kind of selection, we apply the Drury regression for each Cherenkov and scintillation channel, of course, after the clustering. And what you get is the right bottom here. So as same as before, if we measure the stochastic term for the jet energy resolution, we can estimate, we can expect about 26% of stochastic term. And as similar as before, as a pion case, you can see that Drury regression improves the linearity for jet as well. And the final for the resolution case is the angular resolution. So here we now go back to the electron beams from 10 GeV to 100 GeV, and we use the uniform randomly generated events from zeroth tower and first tower center, as you can see in the right diagram here. And to measure the angle of the beam, we use the center of gravity methods to reconstruct theta and phi for at the fiber level granularity. And if we kind of plot the row distribution of the center of gravity, what you see actually is the left one here, because of the intrinsic tower geometry of the Drury regression. If there is some distortion of the measured angle, as you can see here, so we correct or we mapped the reconstructed angle to the diagonal case, as you can see here, so that this measured, the reconstructed angle matches to the generated angle. So by measuring scaling to 1/√E, we can expect the stochastic term of 2.15 milli radian and a constant of 0.04 milli radian for theta, and also very similar for the phi angular resolution. So this is basically because of the excellent lateral granularity of the Drury regression. So that was the fundamental performances of the calorimeter. And from this point, I'll go through the deep learning application using the Drury regression that we are studying so far using the GEON for simulation results. And we are doing three types of studies for these applications in a larger category, for namely a particle ID and jet reconstruction and fast simulation using GAN, or let's say generative adversarial network. So for the particle ID, our goal is to try to do the identification using the shower, and also try to do some quark flavor tagging. And for jet reconstruction, we are trying to regress internal jet reconstruction variable. And for using GAN, we are trying to kind of generate a pseudo shower using this GAN model, which is very, very much faster than the GAN for simulation. But in this presentation, I will only cover the particle ID related studies here, which is based basically related to the quark versus gluon jet discrimination, and also discriminating electron, photons, pions, pi zero, etc. So for input data for this deep learning application, we choose two different approaches. One is the image-based approach, and one other is the point cloud-based approach. For image-based approach, we use the reconstructed energy deposit as a function of eta and phi from scintillation channel, dominated by scintillation channel due to the light yield. And for the point cloud method, we use the reconstructed energy deposit positions, namely as a function of eta phi and depths that I mentioned before in the beginning of this presentation. So we put in the deep learning application is kind of what you see here. Basically, the top row is the single event image of the quark and gluon cases. And the bottom row is the single event kind of point cloud for quark and gluons. So you can see that how during the parameter response to such kind of jets or some intrinsic responses to the multi-particle states. And if we put this kind of data to deep learning application, first of all, we can try to do some kind of classification between the quark and gluon jets. So we, as a preliminary study, we performed this study using 50 GB of U-quark jets and gluon jets and gluon-initiated jets, and tested with both CNN and PointNet model. And the right top here is the average scintillation energy images for the quark-based jets and gluon-based jets. And as you can see that the gluon-based jets has larger multiplicity and dispersion compared to the quark case. And if we extract the actual the final score between the quark and gluon case, what you see is the score distribution in the right, the bottom row here is the score distribution for the image-based model and the point cloud-based model. And by using this score, we extract the responsive curves. And you can see that the area under this responsive curve is almost similar for both type of approaches, and there we can expect around 80% of gluon jet rejection while having 80% of quark jet efficiency, if you see this responsive curve here. And the other one is the particle identification aside from the jets. So we also try to discriminate various types of particle, for example, electron, charged pions, photons, pi zeros, using 20 GeV fixed energy. And As you can see in this right responsive curve for each method, we have excellent electron versus pion separation performance, and not as much as electron versus pions, but we have also great photon versus pi zero separation, because if you see the single event image of the each particle here in the left bottom here, you can see that actually the pi zero will decay into the two photons, and due to the great lateral granularity, the radio computer is able to distinguish these pi zero events and photons or electrons events. So we are considering, based on these performances, we are considering to extend our energy scopes to also the larger or smaller beams of energies, and also try to extend the types of particles to this chromatin, for example, protons and neutrons. So this is a summary. So we have performed the GeonForce simulation with very detailed optical properties implemented. And also due to the computation time, we developed a fast simulation model for optical photon propagation. So this is two important aspects for the simulation frameworks. And for the performance, we measured the electromagnetic hydrogen jet energy resolution, and also the angular resolution, where the performance you can see in this table here. And based on the GeonForce simulation, we also try to study various deep learning applications. For example, particle identification between the quark and gluon jet, and also other single particles, as you can see in the table here. Of course, all the studies that I mentioned up to now is all based in the FCC configuration. Also, I forgot to mention that the magnetic field is not considered at all until now. So there are some extra considerations that we can put into our action items. For example, we are planning to probe performance with potential ETSE configuration. For example, up to now, we used 2 meter or 2.5 meter tower lengths, but we are trying to probe performance with 1.25 meter tower lengths, shorter tower lengths. And also, we have studied with copper for observers exclusively until now, but also we plan to try to do some studies using, for example, tungsten for because of the shorter nuclear interaction lengths, and potentially iron for observers in the future. Okay, I think that's all from my side. So if we have any questions or comments, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, first of all. Are there questions to send you?
Hey, can I go ahead and,
sure,
and ask
Alex
one question? Yeah. So a lot of stuff, you were very fast and sorry, time slow. Can you go to slide 20? Yeah. What I didn't get, how to read these plots. What is horizontal scale? What is vertical scale?
So you mean the right column here, right?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Probably I skipped too much details in this plot. So here, the x-axis is whether, for example, if we, let's say, try to discriminate electron versus charged pions, then so for example, we can expect if we try to have a 95% selection efficiency for the electrons, then we can expect, let's say, 99% of pion rejection. Or if we try to do some...
What does it mean? Okay, so... what does it mean, let's say 0.95 for vertical scale? Does it mean that you deject 95% of the pions or what?
So, I mean, so let's say we are trying to apply some kind of identification, and we are, for example, we are targeting 95% of selection efficiency for the electrons.
Okay.
Yeah. Then according to this response curves, then we can expect that almost every, I mean, 99, more than 99% of the pions, if we apply these such kind of, let's say, electron ID.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what I am getting, so horizontal scale is the efficiency for the first particle, and vertical scale is the efficiency to reject the second particle, right?
Correct.
So yeah, so just for the next time, please make it sound different, because when your curve of this close to one, it's absolutely hard to judge whether rejection factor of this 100 or 1,000, right? So they just show 99 point something, right?
Yes, it is true. So the base, so actually this performance is only based on the fixed energy. So
yeah,
this is just kind of demonstration that we have some excellent performance, but not very detailed to say some points quantitatively.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
John, you are up next.
Sorry. So just a question to this same slide. I can't quite see the curves, but you have an electron versus photon rejection efficiency line on there. And I'm guessing it's up near one, just because I can't quite see where the color is. For a calorimeter, can you give me some sort of a rough feeling of what property the neural network is keying on in order to get that kind of rejection? I would have thought electron photon separation would be almost impossible.
Right, that is correct. So the area on the curve for example 0.5 for electron versus photons, actually the curve is not depicted in this plot because of the scale.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, and good. Yeah, this just this result is saying that actually it would be impossible to discriminate electron versus photons using calorimeter. I mean, honestly, it's a kind of job of the tracker rather, not
sure.
The calorimeter. Yeah, right.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Back to Sasha.
Yeah. You say that you simulate here for 20 GeV, right?
Yes.
Okay, so can you remind me what the distance between the collision point and calorimeter?
Collision point, you mean, so...
Yeah. So what I'm asking just because you show some characteristics for pi zero and photon separation, and that will be strongly dependent on the distance and particle momentus. So that's why what I'm kind of trying to understand what the actual distance between photons will be.
You mean the distance between, I mean, the opening angle of
yes, yes.
Zero?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes. So yeah, for 20 GeV case, actually the opening angle is large enough to distinguish these two photons. And here one cell, I mean the one rectangular cell indicates the 1.5 millimeters.
1.5 millimeters. Okay, okay. So it's really very detailed a kind of view. Okay, good. So yeah.
Out of curiosity, did you evaluate this as a function of eta? Because this should also change as a function of eta, these curves.
Right, that's true. That's something we didn't have done yet. We only did for the very the barrel-most region, let's say.
As unfortunately, we will not be able to be using your simulations in your electron-electron setup. How much of this do you think we can manage to, in quotes, quickly put into Fun for All as well? Because as we will need to study it with the full integration, including the Ridge and the Dirk and so on, I think it wouldn't be prudent to try to implement this in your simulation, but rather port the key components into Fun for All.
Yes, that's actually a very good question. Actually, the framework that we are using for FCC case is not the standalone GeoNetBoard base. Actually, I have a backup slide for the actual the whole view of framework that we are using for FCC case, which we based on the DD4 so-called the DD4 head for detector description. And key forehead for managing all this kind of event data model and generation, etc. So I think if we start from this framework, we cannot manage to implement this simulation in Fun for All in reasonable time scale. But fortunately, we also have some kind of version based on the standalone GeoNetBoard, which you can follow the link in this slide 3, as far as I remember. So if you start from the standalone GeoNetBoard case, then I think it should be take, let's say, it's hard to say, but probably a couple of months, I guess, in a rough scale. Migrate from to the Fun for All framework.
That's a bit discouraging, unfortunately. which components turned out to be the most impactful for you? Was it the light propagation, I suppose?
Yes. Of course, the geometry is the most fundamental one, so we have to.
But right. as you will see, Nico already implemented a version of the geometry. So I think that one we have covered.
I have to look. Maybe I have to look in the Nicolas slide in the next presentation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I assume if we have a geometry of all towers and optical fibers, then the question is that the optical propagation, as you mentioned, and also the optical properties of the fibers, which also the part of the detector construction, I mean, class. And finally, the sensitive detector, I mean, to read out our signals. So that's would be the three biggest consideration that we should have to keep eye on.
Would you be available to help with that part?
yes, partially, I would expect so, but of course, total time for migration should be dependent on the manpowers from our group or either in this team, I mean, the EDSET team, right?
Sure, but we would certainly need your expertise in helping with this, and as such, right. It would be very helpful if you could offer some part of your time.
Yeah, to help us this. For some fraction, I think definitely probably. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Are there further questions? I don't see any hands. If that is so, maybe we switch to Nico's presentation and see what we have already. Nico, can you share your slides?
Yep, one moment. there, now you should see my slides. Okay, so this is now a more basic implementation of a dual readout calorimeter that we currently have in Fun4All. So, I mean, Frederike already presented like the basic setup in one of her presentations before. So what we have is several different setups. So we have a full dual readout in the forward direction that could replace the forward mCal and the forward hCal together, or we have the possibility to use just a small inlay at high pseudo rapidities. The main caveat at the moment is that I have not yet implemented light propagation. So this is something that definitely will need work. And also in terms of clusterization, we are still figuring out how this should work in the end, because I mean, if we look at event displays, it's very hard to figure out how we could make here a clusterizer. And then of course we are, well, in the beginning, or if, let's put it like that. If we would use this full scale dual readout, we might have to use iron or steel to have it as a flux return for the magnet. So we have a bit of a material difference to the previous presentation. And if we would use only this inlay, I think we can get away with not using iron and maybe another material like tungsten or so to get more interaction length. And yeah, so this is the current implementation. And of course, there are also different tower designs available, which mainly differ in terms of how we would consider manufacturing the towers or which fibers we would use. So you see here the three different cases that I have currently implemented. So there's a notch design where the fibers effectively would be put here into these notches. Yellow is the Cherenkov fiber in my plots and gray is the scintillation fiber. Then there's, of course, a case where we don't have these notches, but everything would, for example, be 3D printed and the fibers would be directly in the material. And then there's also a case where we would use, for example, a smaller quartz fiber here. And I mean, this is just to play around a bit to figure out what the effects are of using different sized fibers and so on. So yeah, there are different types, and you will also later on see how they play out in the simulation in the end. And so the main first steps are effectively also what we've seen in the previous presentation. So my simulations are of course just based on the Gion-4 hits in the fibers. So there's no light propagation and efficiencies of the silicon photomultipliers. So it's just based on the Gion-4 hits, but I mean, the basic principle is the same. We're just not accounting for efficiencies or anything like that. So, I mean, in the first step, one has to, of course, calibrate here on electrons. So I simulate electrons, shoot them at a calorimeter, and then determine the calibration constant so that this S over E and C over E is approximately one for these signals. And then in the next step, one can then simulate pions or protons, so just some hadrons. And for this, one also then has to determine the constant fit here to get the hadronic response. And then in the end, I mean, we just apply the normal procedure that we see here in my next slide, where we just here take this distribution and then effectively shift it to the right to take advantage here of our combined information of the scintillation and the Cherenkov information. And so with this, we get, of course, our improved resolution that we can get from the dual readout calorimeter. And in the end, we can then obtain here our resolution by simulating particles at multiple energies, and then doing this procedure where we calculate the energy based on the scintillation and Cherenkov, and then just fit, make Gaussian fits on the energy distribution. And we are left with here this resolution function, in this case for charged pions over quite a large energy range. And so this simple simulation that I currently have implemented has a it's a 16% stochastic term and a 2% constant term. So, I mean, because we are not considering efficiencies or efficiency losses, this is a bit too good for now. But there's also the case that, so everything you've seen here in these slides was for this base design that you see in the bottom left. So the simulations were done here with this notched design with 1 millimeter fibers. And in this case, the Cherenkov fiber was a PMMA, but I've also simulated sometimes less events for quartz fibers. So quartz is then in this case, the green fibers. And here I found something strange because if we just compare, for example, the bottom left and the top right, you see that the distribution shifts effectively to values of S over E greater than unity or greater than one. And this is something I still have to investigate because effectively this would mean that the Cherenkov part of the Cherenkov information is effectively meaningless because, I mean, yeah, exactly. The Cherenkov information would be effectively meaningless because there wouldn't be no effective rotation on this axis here, and therefore no improvement of the resolution. So I think these basic simulations just on the hits, they are not fully cutting it because we are just not accounting for too many effects. And so this is also the reason why now in these next steps, I hope to now collaborate with our Korean colleagues. And I mean, we've seen in the previous presentation that they now have really good implementations for the light yields, the light propagation, their reflection model and so on. And I really hope that I can transfer as much as possible of this into our Fun4All simulation. And then lastly, we should really test to have tungsten as an absorber in our dual readout, because we might need more than just a 5 interaction length, because we only have a 1.5 meter long dual readout calorimeter in the end. And of course, in the end, I also then want to make some performance studies, especially looking at, for example, the photon and Poiseuille separation at high absolute rapidities, and also then jet reconstruction. And that's effectively everything from my side, what we currently have in Fun4All.
Thank you very much, Nico. And of course, this is already quite a bit. I think we shouldn't underestimate what effort it took to actually get this going. In particular, when you look at the full setup, you have a lot of channels which with memory might not scale as
one. Yeah, it was a challenge to get the memory under control. Yeah.
So are there direct questions to Nico? Sanyu, go ahead.
Actually, this is quite impressive already. First of all, let me start from the geometry side. Actually, the notch kind of geometry that you implemented is quite impressive because for our case, actually, we only have this kind of the geometry that the observer fully encircles the fibers, the middle column one. But of course, the notch design would be much more realistic. But my one concern is that, but of course, already mentioned, but what is how do you manage the memory consumption if you implement this kind of notch geometry?
So everything in my simulation is now made via replicas. So I effectively make like a 2x2 fiber block. So effectively what you see here, and then I just replicate it over the full size of the calorimeter. And luckily I can do this because in my simulations, it's not projective. So I can just replicate it as often as I want.
Ah, I see. So probably you would have less than, for example, 2 gigabytes of memory consumption or?
Yeah, the geometry takes 50 megabytes or so.
Ah, okay. So yeah, because for the projective geometry that we are simulating, actually it takes like 4 gigabytes of memory for geometry.
Whoa. So, but I think actually for our case, as we are only wanting it as a forward calorimeter, I think the projective geometry might not be entirely necessary, in particular if we want to go for the inlay. So I think we could go ahead with, at least for now, the non-projective version.
Yeah.
And try to implement as much as we can from the remaining parts, not taking into account the adjusted geometry.
Okay, I see. Yep. One other interesting thing is energy resolution that you have measured with Pions, but of course, I also think that 16% stochastic term is too optimistic. Maybe if you implement the optical properties, I expect some reasonable numbers, because the main performance, let's say, one of the major factor that degrades the performance is actually the light yield of the Cherenkov channel. So we have only, let's say, 70 photoelectrons when we shoot the 1 GeV particles, electrons, for example. So light yield of the Cherenkov channel is so low that actually the statistical fluctuation matters for the resolution. So if we implement the optical properties, I think we may get some sense. And also, another thing that you already mentioned is that the material budgets, for example, if you see the S versus C scatter plot, as you can see, actually the tails in the left bottom, they are the leakages. So probably 1.5 meter with the iron option may not be sufficient to fully contain the shower. But of course, we have to see this further later in detail.
But the question is whether we can afford to have this leakage and still be happy with it. Because there are not too many options what else we can use, in particular if it's really the full-sized one. Or there might not be, let's put it like this.
Of course, that can be an option, but one important aspect that not just the physics performance, but whether you the experimental hall, for example, the GV level particles are flying over the experimental hall and escaping the experimental hall, and I'm not sure whether that would be safe or not.
I think we have slowed them by that point down to enough, because also if you are looking at the other calorimeters, we always have leakage on the end. So even if we would, can you go back to the slide where you show the setups? Yeah. So also in the standardized HCAL, we have leakage on the end. And actually it's more than, I would say 20%, something like that, which we are leaking out in the end. So I wouldn't be too worried about at least the safety in the hall. There will be nobody standing in the hall while we are running anyways.
Okay. So at least this is not just a problem for only during the
calorimeter. No, common problem, because even if we do a standardized calorimeter, we will not be containing the full shower.
Okay, that's something we can note. Okay, thank you.
Are there further questions to Nico? Otherwise, let's thank Nico and we stop sharing and we go to Natalie. Natalie, do you want to share your slides?
Yes, hello. Let me share my screen for a second. Okay, hello everybody. I hope you're seeing on my to my slides and are listening. So I'm going to give a brief update of what is going on with the barrel calorimeter implementing the SkyGlass specifically. So, well, what it has been done is that we modified the SPACAL version of SPHINX to implement the geometry of the SkyGlass, and that is like in a fairly decent stage. Now we need to continue moving in that direction, but I'm not going to present anything on that end yet. However, I use the simple version where I use a single cylinder to check the sizes of the SkyGlass and the segmentation, and try to understand the resolution and performance of the SkyGlass that we will see. So to start, what I'm showing is that I generate a simple sample of electrons at with 10 GeV within a range of -0.2 to 0.2. All the detectors in Fun for All were off except by the calorimeter. And what you're looking in the plots is the response or the energy measure, if I use lead tungsten or if I use SkyGlass, lead tungsten to the left and SkyGlass to the right. The segmentation for the lead glass was 2x2 and for the SkyGlass was 4x4. So what I take from this picture is that I will use 50 centimeter towers for the following slides. So taking 50 centimeters and 20 centimeters for lead glass, then I go ahead and use again a simple sample, but generated electrons with different energies. And this is the response I get of, you can see like that S in this case is kind of double between the lead glass and the lead tungsten and the SkyGlass. And then the next step that I take is to see the response. So because all of this was generated with electrons, so what happens when I just to see what was the response with hadrons. So this is the different responses of the hadrons for kaons, pions, and protons. And finally, what I did is see what happened. Like, as you can see here, the range that I generated the samples was between -0.2 and 0.2. So now the question is what happens if I increase that range and if I slice it. So what are you looking at here are slicings in eta and phi. So to the left, so all of this is again for electrons. And we're looking only to SkyGlass responses. Well, I generated only 10 GeV electrons, and then in the left, I sliced in eta for between -1.2 and 1.2. The slices are about of 0.2. So you can see the energy that was measured with the standard deviation. And to the right, I did the same, but with phi. And again, the vertical axis is the energy measured. So this is what I've seen so far, and these are the plots I wanted to show today, and I really want to know if people have any comments about this.
Thank you very much, Natalie. Can you go back to the slide where you show the depth? So with this depth, what would then be the inner position of the calorimeter, taking into account respectively that we can at most mount it to the magnet?
I think 50 centimeters, well, if in the current setup, 50 centimeters is kind of a lot. I think 40 centimeters is on the edge. I think we can do it. 50 centimeters, we need to maybe request some space.
So 40 centimeters would be starting at a radius of, do you know this by heart?
95 centimeters, yes.
we still have 40 cent. What is the inner radius of the magnet again? I always forget. John, maybe you have this out of your.
I looked that up.
Yeah, yeah, it's what is it? It's a 1.4.
1.4.
Now I'm questioning my numbers, right?
Yeah, me too. As I'm like, eh.
But is it, I have it. I have it in a minute.
It's a 1.4 meter radius, right?
The barrel EMCAL is this. Natalie says it's at the moment the inner radius is at 84 centimeters, and the thickness, like she says, is 50 centimeters. The one thing I wanted to say is, I mean, since as you pointed out, the 40 to 50 centimeters, I think she's using still in the simulation at the moment the earliest, I think, composition. So with a little bit later composition where the density increased, one would expect that the 40 centimeters, I mean, again, something between 40 and 50 centimeters would be fine. So I think we're still in the same situation as before, that 50 centimeters that we allotted for this calorimeter should be fine.
Okay. John just said that we cannot mount anything directly to the magnet cryostat, but would need a frame.
There's a frame that we have also that we also have basically at for the moment. I mean, if you remember from the IB meeting, so basically we put that one at the inner radius at 134 centimeters, so that's your 50 centimeters. And the details, I think they're still a little bit worked out. And so then, of course, also what John said earlier, to try to in this development of this frame to take into account the possible inner hadron calorimeter and so on. So this is ongoing, I would say, at the moment.
I'm just checking that we also then, of course, align with all the other detectors which are in
So if you go back to this IB meeting, so basically this potential barrel option that we showed, that one takes into account all the various detectors that we are aware of. So that's the we have the tracking, we have the ACL guard, we have the support for Dirk and EMCAL, the Dirk itself, the outer support for that. Then another layer, time of flight ACL guard, the barrel EMCAL, as Natalie shows, the 50 centimeters, and then the support for the barrel EMCAL, and then anything outside, of course.
I think at least you and me need to cross-check once our numbers, because at least for the TTL, this would reach right now into this one. So we should adjust in our simulations that we are not overlapping.
Exactly. Yeah, when you sent that to me yesterday, I was already thinking about it. I was thinking about this doesn't quite line up.
The numbers which I sent you were with the current CCMC.
That's fine. We just have to, like you said, we just have to maybe have a chat, offline chat, to make sure it all lines up in the end.
And also we should communicate this with the tracking crew, because of course that imposes a bit of different design options. Let's put it like this.
I think for them, I mean, from what we understand, at least so far with the all silicon, that I mean, I think that should almost line up with what you at least sent to me. So anyway, maybe we should just discuss it in the offline, just to make sure that we have it all.
I think the one which might be offending is the gem stations, which they have in mind also for the barrel.
That's possible. Yeah.
And then we should just make sure that we are not clashing completely.
Absolutely. Very good.
But otherwise, this looks very good, Natalie.
I think so too. I'm very impressed. A lot of progress.
From here, this one, well, it's hard to say, right? Because it's just a very idealistic. This one is encouraging, I think.
Yes, that the variation is not so hard. I'm very happy too.
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, I know it will change when we implement the other the segmentation properly, but I think this is kind of encouraging to see that we don't really need maybe longer pistons in a region than the other or something like that.
Tanya, going back to the slide with the energy resolution, do these resolution numbers seem fitting to you, in particular for the side glass, or are they completely off?
I think
the constant term seems to be rather large.
So, actually, some questions about this.
Sure. I mean, at the moment, I'm still trying to actually understand the numbers, for one, because they are ideal, of course. And then
for two, let me see. So this resolution is that, what is the vertical scale again, Natalie? That's not percent, right? That's something else.
Yeah, that's just like, oh yeah, I think it's percent. Yes, it's percent.
It's percent, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Because then it's of course very ideal. So there's maybe some things we have to look at.
Can I ask, sorry, I joined very late,
yeah.
So I didn't see the beginning of the presentation. And do you simulate any photostatistics, or is it just energy loss on the crystals on the glass?
I think right now it's just energy loss.
So then that may explain a little bit.
But I think before we go into the big production, we should see that at least those numbers for the basic cylinder are even remotely correct. So
right, maybe, I mean, Tanya, especially for the lead tungsten state, exactly. So that one, because it is like Carlos, I think, also says, it's somewhat ideal here, without taking, I think, many effects into account.
Yeah, but even if it's energy loss, I mean, that looks very, very good.
yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say.
I mean, Pukai will show something similar, which looks much worse. So maybe we should try to understand where the difference are coming from.
Right.
But I think here you guys have to talk a bit so that we actually get reasonable numbers.
Yeah.
For the cylinder version.
Absolutely. I think it can be done. It's just that I think we need to just figure out what is the differences.
I agree. This week we should cramp down on this because with the segmentation, it should only get worse, which could explain some parts of this. But I think there's another component which isn't entirely correct.
Yeah. No, I make here some action items for myself. So I have to talk with you, and I have to talk with you and Natalie, with Carlos and Natalie, and somehow tell you what we found out.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Cool.
Sounds good. I think, I may need the new numbers that you said for the material, then I will implement it.
Yeah.
Of course, that's for the side glass side, but the lead tungsten should be fine. But okay, so if you send me the information, I try to debug if I may be not updating a constant that I should, that could be possible.
Let's start with the lead tungsten, because that one we know has to work. And if you understand that one, the other one will follow.
Maybe we should
next look at then Pukai's presentation. And
we can do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just a quick question about this formula. So are you making the arithmetic sum of those three terms, or are you using the quadrature, summing quadrature?
No, it's just the arithmetic sum of those three terms, if I understand correctly your question.
Okay, as far as I understand it, I think you should sum them all in quadrature, otherwise the numbers will be underestimated.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
We might even want to go so far to not fit with the full term, but just with the stochastic term and the constant, because that's what we are often quoting.
If I do that, I put that because this is the one that looks nicer. If I do that, it doesn't look that nice, but yeah, I can do that. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Then let's switch to Pukai's presentation. Pukai, can you share your slides?
Give me 1 second. I'm trying to stop sharing. Okay, got it. Thank you. Thank you all.
Can you see my slide?
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, let's just put my configuration here to remind people who don't know my configuration. Now, and here is for the in and out, and I run for the following resolution result and some hydronic response.
Which Z position have you put them right now?
For Z position is minus 250.
Okay.
Centimeter.
Thanks.
Yes, and here's the eta range for this two different configuration. Okay, so next page. So here's an energy resolution for two different configuration. And the bin I use is 1 to 10 GB gamma, and to heat and the primary particle will cover the whole area of my configuration. So the left hand side plot is for the crystal one, and the right hand side plot is for the side glass one. And here is the field result of the energy resolution Kutrup sum. And yet, as we discussed before, so there's no any physics process simulate here. So everything is really ideal. And so we cannot see any difference between these two configuration. So, okay, so here is the energy resolution configuration. And
so maybe if I can, maybe we can discuss a little bit this, because I had a question maybe, I don't know, for Sasha. So there is a parameter in the, or maybe Frederick knows too, there's a parameter in the digitizer part of it that it's called a number of photoelectrons per MeV. But my guess is that that's not smearing the energy according to any photostatistics. This is just digitizing part of the simulation, right? Because
actually, it really defines the resolution, right? For example, for crystal clarimeter, this is the defining factor for the resolution, right? For stochastic term. So, but as far as I remember, there is a number there like 4,000 something photoelectrons per GeV. So that really the number defines the resolution.
So that one we changed, and we put what Hukai showed in the previous slide. We put 15,000 for lead tungstate and 5,000 for lead glass, so for side glass. But you see that it doesn't change anything basically from the results.
Yeah.
So that's why I was wondering, what does it do, this parameter? Does it really smear the energy according to the Gaussian
distribution? To my knowledge, it should. To my knowledge, it should. So what I can talk to people or even just check it myself. But my what impression is that it really gave what I expected. So 4,000 per GV means how many? Okay, so it's yes. So it should be something like 2% by square root of E, right? So
yeah, but we change it to 15,000, for example.
Yeah,
on the left plot, and it didn't change much, or it even made it worse. But that's I guess just the fit. So it didn't change basically a big factor of anything. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what that is. And then the other thing is that, I mean, as Natalie showed too, the term gamma, label gamma here is significant. It's not something we can neglect in the fit if we want to fit it by a nice shape. So I don't know what that
Because
term is coming
there
from.
Is a noise term there, right?
But where? Is it included in the simulation somewhere? We don't
know. So there is a parameter there which shows the noise, but then show a threshold. So, and what I think people just put there some number from barrel clarimeter where the noise was very much, very sizable. So that's why when I played with such a clarimeter, but I usually switched this term off.
Oh, okay. So maybe we need to find.
So
what
you
that
just
term
change
is.
This parameter, but then put it to some small number. So what I can tell you what exactly the parameter is.
Okay. Yeah, that would be very helpful. We can follow up.
Yeah.
Offline. Yeah. Thank you.
But here, yes. So what you show here, it's really very large term. So
yeah, but it's a combination of this gamma factor and then the fact that we are not sure that we are taking the stochastic term into account correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we need to investigate a little bit that.
Yeah.
Okay, I will write you an email later. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, so for the hydronic response, and here I just use the pion as a primary particle, and to run for my two different configurations. So this is for crystal for inner one, and I use the e-dimension cut. So you can see a dashed line in the six part here, and for me is this at here, and the energy for the, each pion is from the cluster reconstruction, and I always pick the maximum reconstructed one, and the peaks directly from the simulation information. So I didn't use any tracker information here. So here's the result, but I didn't have too much statistic, so. There's a big fluctuation for these spins, so I will improve my statistic later and to see what happened later. So this is for a crystal part, and for the side glass is the same here. And yet I didn't have too much statistic for side glass one here. So here's the result. And let's see from my side.
Thank you very much. For the pion rejection, have you checked that the minimum ionization peak is at the right position for the respective calorimeter types? Because of course it's very good to see the E over P, but I think we should also check that the minimum ionization peak is where it should be.
No, I haven't checked it. I haven't checked that.
Or at least where we expect.
That's a good point. Yeah, we should check that too. Yeah.
Because that could.
For 1 GV plot, you can see that it is at about 0.3 GV, right? So, but I think it's roughly correct, but of course we can make more detailed check, you know, what exactly the number should be, but 0.3 GV, it looks like the
can you go back, yeah. Can you go back to the crystal? Because I remember in Alice, the lead tungsten is at 200, which looks about the same here. So, okay. Okay, and then I think the next thing which we should check is the pion photon separation, I'm guessing. Okay. For your setup in the different calorimeters?
What do you mean exactly?
So until which momentum can we separate pions and photons simply by the pions overlapping in one cluster?
But isn't that just something geometrical? You can just calculate, so it's just the opening angle of the two photons, right?
Well, it's also a clusterization property, because at some point, in principle, yes, you should merge them, but depending on how good our clusterizer does, it can do it up to a larger.
Okay. There is a fuzzy limit. So you would like to see the angular.
Angular separation of the
photons.
And how well
we
then
have a very good, so that we can do the plot, but we don't have a good feeling of what's needed.
Yeah, that's right? That's why we are asking Carlos, your physics colleagues.
Right, but even the physics colleagues, they don't have a good feeling, because you know it's a complex question.
I know.
To give a number.
I think this we really should nail down, because for the EM calorimeters, this will be a number which we need to know in all three directions, actually. And I'm somewhat expecting that the forward direction will be there, the more demanding one, because there are simply more pions going that way. Pi zeros, for that matter, at least. Very good. Very nice progress. Have you managed to port part of this already into the general software package?
No.
So what's the procedure for that? Shall we try to do it ourselves, or do we send
you open a pull request and we go through it and we make a review and then we see that we get it merged.
So in practice, can you say what a pull request is?
So you have forked from one of the directories. So for instance, right. you should have forked from two directories. In this case, it would be the EIC detectors under GitHub EIC. And then it would be, in addition, the macros would go to EIC macros under EIC. And what you would do now is you would make the diff to the latest version. So rebase your directories respectively, apply your patches accordingly, and then you push this into your directory and open a merge request to the actual directory from which you have forked. And then it will automatically give us an email, the ones which have actually the rights to merge it. And we will go through the code and see whether any offending stuff is there. And if there is none, we will probably run a compilation test. Either me or Jin will do that. And then once the compilation test has succeeded, we will merge it into the software and it will be available. At least in the EIC package. And then we would port it to the Etcher package because that is a bit more convoluted.
So sorry, this is a basic question outside this meeting, but for those who are not that familiar with GitHub and so on, are there some instructions on how to do that, what you just described?
There should be, but if you want to, I can also walk you through this in a private.
Yeah, from the Git clone command to the...
Yeah.
Pull request or push request or whatever. Yes.
I can also send you my Git cheat sheet if you want.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Just the list of 3-4 comments that we need to make so that
yes. But actually the request to merge will come completely through the online interface. So you push into your directory and then you do online the request to merge.
I see. Okay.
Okay. Any further questions to Pukai? If not, I think the next in line is Tanya. Tanya, do you want to share your slides?
Sure. It's just a few illustrations and some of them, I think, yeah, here we go. Some of them, or some of us have already seen them. Okay, so what I wanted to show is basically just following up from what I said in words last week, and you have basically people who attended the IB meeting or weekly meeting, bi-weekly meeting on Monday already saw much of this. So this is the illustration of how the central detector looks like or looked like maybe 2 weeks ago or so. And what I'd like to kind of point out here, and sorry I didn't rotate it more, but you see here the electromagnetic calorimeter electron end cap, the one that just Pukai just talked about. Here in this case, still with this somehow struts out here this frame. Then the electromagnetic calorimeter in the barrel, and then here the dirk. And what's really of interest is electromagnetic calorimeter end cap, barrel plus dirk, because well, it depends a little bit how you orient the dirk, and the calorimeter, of course, has to follow whatever the dirk is doing. So what you see here is the prism, where the readout is on the right-hand side on the hadron end cap. So I'm kind of, if you see my mouse, the pointer, I'm just kind of circling it here. There's this kind of thing that goes up at an angle, I don't know, 45 degrees or so. And what happens here in this configuration is that there was some interference with the dual ridge, which was a little bit difficult to resolve because there's constraints on how much you can actually tilt this prism here. So then the present configuration, some of you then, I guess, in the bi-weekly meeting also saw yesterday, is to change the orientation of the dirk. So again, you see here the this orange block, that's the dark bars in the barrel. And then move the read out the prism to the left-hand side, to the electron side. So you see it here, or here, so it's kind of a cut open. So you see the readout pieces here, the readout pieces here, so this little prism. And then accordingly, of course, to do that, the electromagnetic calorimeter shrinks a little bit and moves in. And then it's of course supplemented with the electromagnetic calorimeter in the barrel that's shown here. This one is not quite yet the one that Natalie is working on, but the geometry will be the same. So the advantages here for the Dirac, when we talk with the PID group, is that this prism is kind of in the shadow of the electromagnetic calorimeter, so that's nice for that detector. The bars and so on, everything seems to be favorable for that, so the Dirac group is quite happy with this orientation and prefers this, in fact. And then the EM call, of course, as that moves a little bit in, but then of course the frame that I showed on the previous page won't work here, so it's some sort of minimal frame that one would need now. And it would also mean that the cooling would have to be done from the inside, and that's something that Carlos' team is looking at, or will be looking at very soon. So that's, I think, already most of it. So the main thing here is, I guess, this is more for the Dirac group, for the PID group, just to show they needed 13 centimeters of space between this is the hadron calorimeter here right now on the left-hand side, and then here's the prism that I talked about for the cabling. So that's what they have here. And then of course, for the servicing, we know from, I think also Orr showed it yesterday, that this H-cal of course splits away. And so for the servicing, there's infinite in access to these prisms, and also of course to the E-cal in the end. So that was this discussion. And then on this page is shown just to look for any interferences, one could say, for this so-called LD cone that you can see in SketchUp. So there's very little of that. The one thing that I wanted to point out here is the coverage for the EMCAL NCAP goes to about 1.8, where the minus 1.8, that is, where basically a good resolution was requested by the yellow report to minus 2, so that's good. The barrel starts at about minus 1.6, so there's a little gap in between. To address it, one could consider then making blocks, in particular in the region between 1 and 2 projective, possibly. So that's something that we should look at, how to, when we deal with the details of this calorimeter, of these calorimeters, these two calorimeters. And then showing kind of what Natalie is working on in SketchUp. So this is not from Gen4, this is from actually the mechanical SketchUp picture. So that's how it would look like. It's the 50 centimeters. And then here you see these blocks arranged at the moment, kind of like in Panda. So segmented, just looking at the center, this beamline. What I meant earlier is to say one could then also make these blocks that are in the region -1, -2 in ADA, make them projective, so kind of pointing at the center to alleviate this issue of a little gap between these two calorimeters. So make it more continuous. Basically, I have a cool continuous electromagnetic calorimeter in this end cap here.
Do I see this now correctly, that the calorimeter would not be Z-symmetric anymore? And reach out further to the electron side, the barrel one.
So maybe this one is the better view on it. So yeah,
Because if I now recall correctly, at least in Fun for All, we have metal plates which are coming down from the magnet at exactly where the magnet ends. And I don't know whether those can actually be removed or whether they are essential for.
Yeah, the magnet is here, right?
Yeah, and there would be metal, at least in Fun for All, we have their metal structures which reach downward, which would right now be cutting into your calorimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I have to talk to Jin about this, but I don't see a trivial way to remove this in the current magnet, so we would need to work on that geometry then, of course, again. Because otherwise, that is a very harsh conflict.
Yeah, just of course, that would be material that shouldn't be there.
Not just maybe, but that would be steel.
It would be there. Okay. that should be. Yeah, that's right.
And
one of these modifications. Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether we can trivially remove those in reality.
I think if I'm correct in understanding what you're talking about, Frederic, those are the what are called the inner H-cal end rings. That are basically the support structure that transfers the load for the inner detectors onto the outer HCAL barrel steel.
So you
can certainly change how you do that, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
And you will need to do that. You know, in this picture here, I think it's replaced by this orange structure that is basically attaching the EM cal to the outer. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Indeed,
so
indeed.
So those end rings can go away.
Okay.
But I guess the point is, Federica, you have to actually do it in JN4, otherwise we get weird results. Okay.
Because otherwise we will have a bit of a fun thing when running this.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, that's a very good point. That's right. And then in reality, right, it would be a structure like John points out, like this. And then we have to see if that's something in JN4 to implement right now. Or
I think we would need to implement a basic thing of this, because this will interfere with the resolution of the hadronic calorimeters.
Mm-hmm. This one, I think the mechanical model you can directly get. I think I forgot his name from the. It's a Brookhaven designer, I think.
What I would suggest for this is you could take the existing design that's there now for the S-Phoenix inner HCAL and just shrink it down so that it fits the appropriate radial space. And that would already have the scintillating tile instrumentation that I was talking about before. So I think you can do that by just modifying the existing inner HCAL. And it's basically a box beam that we shoved scintillating tiles into. So it's a very efficient structure for holding a very heavy weight.
So John, as you are proposing this, do you want to take care of doing it?
I can't. No, that's fair. No, Frederick, that's totally fair. If I'm going to open my mouth, I should put my money where my mouth is. I can certainly look into doing that, but I can't do it until probably the end of this week. But I think I can modify that geometry in a rather straightforward way.
That would be very much appreciated, I think.
Yeah, no problem.
Because this will need some deintegration from S-Phoenix software, because we now split the two.
Oh, yes.
So that will need a slightly more modification than you anticipated would.
I don't think it should be a problem to sort of.
No, I'm just saying, be careful. We have to handle this a bit.
Oh, carefully. I understood. No, I'm well aware of the split. Absolutely.
Okay.
Very good. Well, good that we looked at it today. So we discovered something, or rather noticed something.
And I think the other one which we should make sure is right now the Dirk has no prism in FunFall, which is also something which we should fix.
So you need this whole piece.
Yep. That is not in FunFall right now. Essentially what they have at the moment is only the bar.
I see.
At least in the version which is committed. Maybe they have a private version which does contain more, but in the one which is committed, it's only the bar.
Okay. Yeah, good point. I would think that Greg and Joe probably have their private version of it.
Well, then we should collapse these private versions as soon as possible into a common one, because otherwise we will have severe overlaps once that all happens. And this is normally not trivially resolved if you have this too late.
Yeah.
So in your SketchUp version, at what radius do you right now have the HCAL? Because we have an HCAL implemented, we just didn't know where to put it.
This
no, the one in the electron side.
The electron side. There you caught me. I don't know. I have to check.
Tell me the inner radius, and we'll put it at the correct the inner Z position, and we'll put it at the right position.
Okay.
Because that was one of the numbers which we were like, we don't know where to put it.
Okay.
Nico implemented it, but it's currently floating a bit in Never Ever Land.
Right. No, I have to look it up. I mean, at the moment, I just cannot recall where it is.
Okay.
Okay, I'll do that. Another action item. Okay, very good. Okay, I guess I'll stop sharing then, unless there's anything else.
And then we have the last presentation of today, which is by Justin. Justin, can you share your slides?
Sure. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, that's fine.
I've been having some problems with my network lately. But, let's see how it's going. Yeah, so I also, very short update. We met, Nathalie and myself and Freddie met on Friday and decided sort of a strategy to go forward. And one of the things is to look at some other variations of the Hess Phoenix Bay cow. Sort of a longer term thing is to use a different fiber composition and, or sorry, powder composition and extend the blocks. But that's kind of a longer term thing. I started working on that, but probably it'll be next week before I have anything to say about that. But another sort of quick thing to look at was just to improve the light collection efficiency, because currently in S Phoenix, it's around 23%. What we understood from Craig's talk, what sort of, you know, I know there's like an inefficiency on the light collection. So we just wanted to try to look at improving that and see what kind of improvement to the resolution that makes. So I did that, and so far I just put it in the S Phoenix framework because it was easier for me. I did spend a couple of minutes trying to put it in the Etchy version, but there was just a few things that needed kind of pointed to the right macro, and it was just faster to do it in S Phoenix, but I can put it in the Etchy code. Actually, that's, I had sort of a question following up on Puke's talk, or the discussion there was like, where should I put something like this if I want to eventually make a pull request, but I'm sure right now we're not really there yet anyway, but so maybe we can come back to that at the end. But this is, so there's a qualitatively, you definitely see an improvement in the resolution. I need quite a bit more statistics. I don't know if this is true for the other cases. I know I've run some of the simple cylinders. They're a lot faster than the full S Phoenix Spay calorimeter. So I'm not sure how fast other people are running, but to get decent statistics to sort of actually make these real fits, I'm going to need definitely to run over Condor if I want to run it over like the whole ADA range or something like that, and get good statistics. So, and some systematics, but anyway, so this is just kind of a first look, and you can kind of see that it does indeed improve the resolution. But I didn't really want to quote the fit parameters. I mean, currently in these fits, it's about percent or two better on the constant term. I think you need better fit statistics to actually get the parameters and look at them.
But each of those terms is still significantly better than what we are normally quoting for the Sparkle, if I recall, or? No, maybe not.
Yeah, it's interesting too. Yeah, the behavior at really high energy.
Yeah.
Very good. Like I said, it's one ADA, so maybe that's part of the question. It's really small ADA ring that I'm throwing in, so maybe, maybe when I change that, it'll sort of change. I know there certainly is a bit of non-uniformity in the response for the S Phoenix Spay cow, so that might actually be the explanation.
Okay. Very nice progress. Questions to Justin? If not, I think anybody who wants to learn how to merge stuff, shoot me a message and I'll share on the MetaMost my Git cheat sheet to actually push it up. And I'll try to make a tutorial on where to push what.
Yeah.
It'd be great to link a tutorial to our wiki.
Okay. I'll see that.
When you get around to it, not today. Once it's available, I'm pretty okay that's a good place for it to go.
I'm okay on how to do the merge, the pull request, but it's just I didn't know exactly where, you know, there's a bunch of macros in the detectors area. And so I didn't know if I should use EIC detector. I think maybe Nathalie was using that before.
Well, the point was to first push everything to EIC detector and then cherry pick to go to Edger. So that in principle, also any other collaboration would have the freedom to use what we improved for the EIC detectors in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess in this case, it's actually only a change in the core software code. So, I guess I just hard coded a change. So we would want to propagate that eventually to some kind of parameter.
Yes.
So
yes.
I guess we're kind of far from there right now. And I don't know, like, does it sound like a good strategy? Let's look at the results before I kind of make it nice that way.
Yeah.
I talk with that about that with Jin because I was including the side glass material in the core software. Mm-hmm. And there is actually a wiki for that. I will put it in the Git. I don't know. I think that is basically step by step what people have to do. Of course, this is the version of Sphinx, so I don't really know if there is a like fun for all. For us that we can follow, but that is basically the same steps we have to follow.
Yeah, our GitHub names will just be a bit different because we have more directories into which we need to distribute the different software components. But yes, this pretty much looks like what I would have given you as well. All right. Are there further general comments? Otherwise,
my general comment. Sure. It was an extremely productive meeting. I was very impressed. Thanks to all the presenters.
All right. Then we'll see each other next week. And for those who want to come on Thursday for the general meeting with the detector, with all detector groups. Hoping to see many of you there to butt in on what me and Yongsoon are saying, if we are saying something wrong. And otherwise, we'll see each other next week to kind of see where we are for the final simulations for the first campaign.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks all.
Bye.
Bye.